This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Yesterday, we talked to MIT economist Andrew Low about his faith in the good that financial markets can do. Notwithstanding the near collapse of the global economy, Low argued that with proper financial engineering, the markets can play a big role in solving some of our most vexing challenges, from curing cancer to resolving the energy crisis to ending global warming.
Today, a very different perspective about markets and what they can and cannot achieve. The title of Michael Sandel's book states his case pretty succinctly: What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of the Markets. Sandel argues that over the past three decades, market thinking has taken over society so much that today nearly everything is for sale. Not just yachts, sports cars, and fancy vacations, but healthcare, education, criminal justice, even citizenship.
Sandel says a society that sells nearly everything to the highest bidder is a society that's fostering inequality and corruption. And he says we arrived at this point almost by accident, without consensus and without much needed debate about whether this is where we want to be.
According to Sandel, we have drifted from having a market economy to being a market society. And Michael Sandel joins us now. He's the Ante and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard and author of What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of the Market. And Michael Sandel, welcome to Radio Boston. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
So tell us how we got here. As we mentioned, over the last three decades, you've said that we've developed and embraced this sort of idea about market triumphalism. What do you mean by that, and how did we get there?
Well, to begin, I think we should notice there's a big difference between a market economy, which is a tool, a valuable and effective tool for organizing productive activity, and a market society, which is a place where pretty much everything is up for sale. It's a way of life where market thinking and market values reach into spheres of life, health, education, civic life even, previously governed by non-market values. And that's my main concern.
Mm. So give us some examples about these market forces, market values reaching into spheres of life where they weren't before.
Let's start with a couple of seemingly small examples.
Sure.
If you're sentenced to a jail term in Santa Barbara, California, and you don't like the standard accommodations, you can now buy a prison cell upgrade for about $90 a night. If you go to Capitol Hill and you want to sit in on a congressional hearing or on a Supreme Court oral argument, but you don't want to stand in the long lines for the access to the seats, sometimes for hours, even overnight, you can now go to a line-standing company which will hire homeless people and others to wait on the line for you until your moment arises. Now, these may seem like small things, but look at how we fought the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. There were, in both of those places, more private military contractors on the ground than there were U.S. military troops. This isn't because we had a public debate about whether we wanted to outsource war to private companies. It just happened. And I think in many domains, this has been happening over the past three decades.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's interesting because we do have this notion, at least these days, that it's normal for markets to control just about everything. But you argue that if you look at history, it hasn't always been that way, right?
Right. And there are a few areas where we still do not allow markets. It's against the law to have a free market in kidneys for transplantation in the United States, though there is a black market globally for organ sales. We don't allow people to put their children up for sale or for adoption agencies, to put a price tag on the most so-called desirable children. And we don't allow people to sell their votes. By standard economic logic, it's not easy to explain why not, because after all, there are a lot of people who don't use their votes. They don't show up at the polls. Why not let them get some value out of it by selling their votes to the highest bidder? There will be people willing to buy. So there are a few outposts where we don't allow market values to penetrate, but fewer and fewer these days. And what I'm suggesting is we need to step back and ask where markets serve the public good and where they don't belong.
And where don't they belong? I mean, the idea that it's all for sale or so much of it is for sale, it sounds sort of awful, but why, in fact, is it a bad thing? What's the result on society of so much being up for sale?
Right. There are two results. One is the more money can buy, the more it hurts to be of modest means. If, as you mentioned earlier on, the only thing money could buy were fancy vacations and yachts and luxury goods, then inequality wouldn't matter so much. But if money can buy access to health and education and access to a political voice, then inequality matters more than it otherwise would. The other reason to worry is that often market values, if introduced into certain domains of life, like health and education, can crowd out important non-market values. Let me give you one example. It's a controversial question. Many cities around the country are trying to lift up the academic achievement of underperforming kids in school by offering financial incentives, cash for good grades or high test scores. Even in the case of Dallas, they're offering $2 to third graders for each book they read. The goal is laudable, to improve academic performance. But is there the risk that the attitudes that we're conveying, the lessons we're teaching, are that reading and learning are chores to be done for pay rather than for their own sake or the love of learning?
It's one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, on the one hand, I so understand the concerns that you raise. On the other hand, isn't this the result of who we are, who we've always been? I mean, the Puritans and their religious faith aside, some of the first settlers that came to America were, it was about making money. It was about establishing markets. It was sort of, it is who we are to our core to a certain extent.
Well, yes and no. And I should emphasize, I'm not arguing against markets as such.
Sure.
I'm arguing for keeping markets in their proper place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we've lost grip of in the last three decades. I think it goes back to the early 80s, when there was a kind of market faith. Goes back, I think, to the election of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. There was a belief that markets were the solution, government was the problem. But what's interesting is that market faith persisted even after they passed from the scene and were replaced by centrist or center-left political figures. The underlying faith that markets are the primary instrument for achieving the public good, that faith has not really been challenged or debated in our public life between Democrats and Republicans. And I think that's the deep assumption that we need to step back and examine.
So you argue for this debate. Tell us what that debate would look like. I mean, I gather that it needs to go farther than greed is bad, bankers need to do a better job at understanding risk, we need more regulatory reform, we need less regulatory reform. It needs to go beyond that, right?
Yes, exactly. So, for example, in education, we have all of these debates about pay for performance. We mentioned the case of offering students cash for good grades in many schools around the country. They're debating whether to offer teachers bonuses based on the performance of the kids in their classes. Now, many teachers find this insulting because it seemed to suggest that if only you were paid for results, you would try a little bit harder. The teachers say, look, we're trying very hard as it is. So I think in education, there are many debates, many areas where we have to have this debate. Healthcare is another.
Healthcare is a big one, isn't it? Yeah.
We've had the debate about healthcare in the current presidential campaign, but what's striking about the debate that we've had is it's really been on the surface of the hard moral questions to do with healthcare. It's been about cost containment. It's been about the individual mandate to some extent. But there's been relatively little engagement with the fundamental moral questions about healthcare. What do we owe one another as citizens? Should people's access to health care depend on their ability to pay? This is the larger moral question. And then on the other side, there's a certain claim about individual freedom. I think in general, we have shied away in our public discourse from engaging with big moral questions that matter, not only with regard to markets, but I think this is one area where we need a morally more robust kind of public discourse.
You know, you mentioned healthcare reform. I don't want to get too sort of off into the weeds of healthcare reform, but when we talk about the debate that didn't happen there, what do you mean by that? I mean, was it that we were pretty much debating about how to tinker around the edges of a market-based health insurance system, as opposed to the big question, should healthcare be subject to a market?
Yes, yes.
So that's the question we didn't have.
Yes, and I think partly as a result, the Obama administration's case for healthcare sounded, for the most part, tinny, empty, managerial, and technocratic, except in rare moments. Former Senator Kennedy, who made healthcare a central issue, he knew how to address it in explicitly moral terms. But the real question to do with healthcare is, what do we owe one another as citizens? What is the role of health in the good life? And are the libertarians, the conservatives, right that an individual mandate is a fundamental violation of freedom? Those questions about the good life, about freedom, about the meaning of shared citizenship, those are really the big questions that we should have been debating and for the most part really weren't.
Listeners, what do you make of Michael Sandel's argument about the moral limits of markets? Do you agree that we are now ruled by market forces at the expense of civic values? If you have a comment or a question for Harvard political philosopher Michael Sandel, give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Michael, where's the forum for this debate? Is it in Washington? Is it among our political leaders? Because I ask that question because these days that seems like I wouldn't be so optimistic about that debate taking shape and shaping up very well in Washington, given the tenor of political discourse that we hear these days.
I think that's right. The terms of political discourse today, I think, are impoverished. And I think the reason they're impoverished, consisting mainly of shouting matches and ideological food fights, they're impoverished because I think they're empty for the most part. I think we've hollowed out our political discourse by shying away from big moral questions. The reason we shy away is we're aware that these questions are controversial. People disagree. But I think we've hollowed out our politics and created a largely managerial, technocratic kind of public discourse, which people find uninspiring. And so my hope is, and here the media has a role to play, I think higher education and the public schools have a role to play in fostering a richer kind of civic education and debate. But the basis for my hope is that people across the political spectrum are deeply frustrated with the way we talk about politics today. They want a public life of larger meaning and purpose. And I think one area, not the only one, but one area where we can have a morally more engaged kind of political debate is in this area of markets, buying and selling. What should and what should not be a proper role for markets and market values?
One of the big issues, and you address this in a really interesting and provocative way in the book, is this question of whether or not markets actually affect the goods and services that are being sold. As you point out, economists usually assume that markets are inert, they're amoral, they don't have a sort of judgment or an effect on the goods that they sell. They merely set the price. But you would argue that that's wrong.
I think it is wrong. Sometimes markets change and diminish the nature of the goods being bought and sold. If we take this example of whether to pay kids to read books, the worry is that the experience of reading a book will be changed if it's something that the child does mainly to make money. Some economists have done experiments showing how marketizing goods changes their character.
There's a really dramatic example. You write very interestingly about the life insurance industry, of course, which had its origins in the idea of mitigating the impact of death on surviving family members. But it sort of turned into, it was gradually corrupted and sort of turned into a betting scheme against people living.
Right. Betting on the lives of strangers.
Yeah.
It came out some years ago that Walmart and other big companies were taking out life insurance on their employees, not just their CEOs, who would be expensive to replace if they died, but their maintenance workers and their janitors. These were life insurance policies, the proceeds of which were collected by the company, not the family, if the worker died. It came to light in a series of Wall Street Journal articles. Many companies were doing it. And the question really arises, is that what life insurance is for? Is it really, isn't there a difference between protecting one's family against financial catastrophe, which is an important social good, and letting companies bet on the lives of their employees, or for that matter, strangers, simply as an investment vehicle? And the worry is, I mean, most people find this troubling, and I think the reason we find it troubling is that betting on life somehow undermines human dignity, coarsens our respect for life, especially if it becomes widespread. And now there's an enormous industry of secondary markets in insurance policies. Wall Street is even now bundling these life insurance policies taken out on the lives of strangers and doing for them what they did for the home mortgage market.
Another extreme example of this that I'd like you to talk about, we've got some listeners, by the way, I'm going to bring them into the conversation in just a moment, but I don't want to let you go without this example that I didn't know anything about in terms of what's for sale. The media dubbed this. This came out of the Pentagon, a website that was initially set up by DARPA, the Pentagon's Advanced Research Agency. The media dubbed it the so-called terrorism futures market.
Right.
Tell us about this. I mean, this is truly frightening.
Well, this was after September 11th. The Defense Department proposed setting up an online betting parlor, really, where you could bet on the likelihood of where the next terrorist attack would be, where they would strike. You could also bet on what foreign leader would be assassinated in the next
year. And
when
you say bet, it's not just an office pool. It's actually a mechanism by which you can enrich yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
And they thought that through because of various ideas about crowdsourcing, that this would be a way of gathering valuable intelligence to promote national security. When it became widely known in Congress, there was moral outrage, and the plan was dropped. But it raises an interesting question about betting on life or on disaster or coming to have a financial interest in the misfortune of others. The underlying objection, I think, is that this is debasing, it's coarsening, it's corrupting of the kind of attitudes we want to promote toward life and toward one another. And here's another example, to go back to the point you were making earlier, Anthony, about the way in which using market mechanisms does not leave the goods being exchanged untouched. It sometimes changes their meaning, and we need to be alive to that.
Mm. Listeners, we're talking to Michael Sandel. He's a Harvard political philosopher, author of What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. Let's get a couple of calls. Sam is calling from Bedford. Hi, Sam. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having the show. It's very timely. I would like to ask our guest if he thinks that for-profit systems are compatible with the delivery of health services or housing. It just seems that we're totally dominated. I don't think of them as markets. I think of them as for-profit mechanisms. I mean, a market is kind of a quaint idea of, you know, two people having an exchange over what they think is a fair price for a good or a service, when in fact I don't think that's what goes on at all in most of the financial relationships that go on in my life. I don't really have too much say in the matter.
Hmm.
I don't.
Well, Sam, let me put the question to Michael Sandel: the idea that for-profit ventures are sympathetic with the causes of education, healthcare, that kind of thing.
Well, I think Sam raises an important question. I would not say that there's anything wrong with for-profit institutions or organizations as such. Often they are the most efficient way of organizing economic activity. But when we start talking about for-profit schools, for-profit prisons, for-profit private military companies, Then I think for-profit hospitals. Then I think some of these larger social and moral questions come into play. To what extent will viewing a service or a practice primarily as an instrument, a way of making money, rather than a mission, a way of serving the public good? I think we have to have this debate case by case. I do not want to make a blanket case against for-profit institutions, but I do think I do want to make the case for having a more explicit public debate case by case, especially in the areas of the environment, civic life, national security, criminal justice, health, and education, and I would say also family life, where often for-profit instruments or market relationships can crowd out important competing values.
Let's take another call. Frank is calling from the Tobin Bridge. Frank, keep your eye on the road. Good to have you on the show.
I've got you on speaker. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. My original question kind of related to what the gentleman before me just asked, so I have posed a new question. How do we have that kind of conversation about what markets are just and what markets are unjust when the people who are making the decisions, be it the a bureaucrat at the FDA, like the guy who used to be the head of Monsanto, not the head, but worked for Monsanto, that now runs the FDA. How do we have these kind of conversations when the folks who are kind of the market players are in this iron triangle between government and private industry? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Michael.
Frank raises an important question. It isn't obvious what can be the right kind of forums for a more serious substantive debate about the role of markets that includes a moral debate. I think that the media has a role to play. I think higher education does, equipping citizens to think critically about moral and civic questions, including markets. I also think the institutions of civil society can be places, forums, to begin this discussion. I don't think the political parties are very likely to address these questions in a serious way unless a demand for a better kind of politics bubbles up from these other sources.
Mm. You know, we've just come through, or perhaps we're still trying to come through, this near financial catastrophe. Right. Markets failed, greed triumphed, we underestimated risk. It seems like when we come out on the other side, we would be digesting certain lessons, maybe even beginning this debate that you're talking about the limits, the moral limits of the marketplace. Is there any evidence that we have absorbed some of these lessons in your view?
Sadly, very little. Mm. I think one of the striking things about the aftermath of the financial crisis is how little rethinking and public debate resulted. About the relation between markets and morals. We had some arguments about regulation, but that was about it. And so I think that there is a much bigger debate. In fact, I think it's the great missing debate in our public life about the moral limits of markets.
Let's take another call. Roger is calling from Chelmsford. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. This is an area of interest to me because I studied the theory of economic rent, or societal rent, which came out in the 1920s. And the basic theory is, be it utilities, education, whatever, what is the value to the society versus the value to the overall market? In other words, we have to, as a society, be willing to pay the rent to live in the society. And that can be applied to healthcare, et cetera. The big question is, how are you going to measure the societal rent?
All right. Well, let me give it a try, Roger.
Thank you, Roger.
I think one way of putting what I take Roger's point to be is that what the economists call efficiency, economic efficiency, is not everything. It's not the whole of life. It's not a self-sufficient public philosophy or civic vision, because we care about a whole range of values. Not just economic efficiency. We've been talking about the way economic exchange, Anthony, sometimes changes the character of goods. And one of the things it changes is the character of civic life. You can see this in large ways and small. When I was a kid, I've always been a baseball fan. I would go to see, it was in Minnesota where I grew up. Mm. Would go to see the Minnesota Twins play. And do you have any idea the gap between the most expensive seat and the cheapest seat in the bleachers?
I'm going to guess probably it starts at, $20 and goes up to a factor of 10, 20?
Well, these days.
Oh, back then.
In the mid-60s when I was a kid going.
Oh, yeah. What, factor of 2 or 3, I would guess.
Something like, yeah. The most expensive box seat was $3.50, and the cheapest seat in the bleachers was $1. And the effect was that when you went to a baseball game, it was a place where CEOs and mailroom clerks sat side by side. And everyone waited in the same long lines for the restrooms and ate the same soggy hot dogs. And when it rained, everyone got wet. Now, some decades later, all of that's changed. Skyboxes came in. Mm. And now when you go to almost any sports stadium, the privileged and the affluent sit in the air-conditioned skyboxes. And it's no longer true that everyone gets wet when it rains.
And this is an example of, or what you call, the skyboxification of society. And it extends, obviously, beyond the playing field and the stadia.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. The skyboxification of American life is what I call it. And I think it's been unfolding over the last two or three decades, where not only in when we go to sporting events, but in almost every domain of life, there are fewer and fewer occasions when people from different social backgrounds bump up against one another, encounter one another. And so we live and work and shop and play in different places. Our children go to different schools. And this is a corrosion, I think partly at the hand of inequality, but also at the hand of market values, that actually is corrosive of the commonality that democracy requires.
Mm. Last question. You call for a debate about how far the markets should the sort of market value should extend into our civic lives. Given the current health of public debate in this country, how optimistic are you that we can have this debate? Are we up to the task?
It's not clear. And the hope that we may have such a debate consists, I think, mainly in the fact that people want something better, more substantive. I think people are deeply frustrated, not only in this country, but in democracies around the world, with the state of our public discourse. They want something that addresses big moral and civic questions. And I think one of the first such questions that we need to debate is, well, where do markets serve the public good? And where may they crowd out moral and civic values worth caring about?
Well, Michael Sandel, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for bringing these ideas to us. We're very grateful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Sandel is a professor of political philosophy at Harvard University. His book is called What Money Can't Buy: The Moral Limits of Markets. He'll be speaking at Temple Isaiah in Lexington next Monday at 7:30 p.m. Stay with us. Coming up, His Holiness the Dalai Lama visits the Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.